KLOS and KLOS HD1, Los Angeles. This is the Rock of Southern California. Now, shining a light on the people, organizations, and events that bring Southern Californians together. This is Spotlight on the Community with your host, Doug McIntyre.
But as a kid growing up in New York, they've had 4 a.m. closing time in New York for years and years and years, and the argument was made that it actually makes the road safer. Let's talk about that with the author of this bill, and the assembly has passed it. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show State Senator Scott Wiener. Senator Wiener, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. Actually, the Senate passed the bill.
It's the assembly. I had it backwards. Yeah. I apologize for that.
Yeah, we did our job.
Yes, you did. Now, talk to us about, because it seems, now people are going to hear this say, how could it possibly make the road safer if you kept the bars open later?
Right. Well, so first of all, it's important for people to understand that this bill will not automatically make every bar and club in California open till 4 a.m. It's a local control bill. Every community will decide for itself, do we stay at 2 a.m. or do we want to go later? It's a local decision. Having everyone crush onto the streets at 2 a.m., having every single bar and nightclub close at exactly the same time, creates a problem. And especially when you have a concentration of nightlife, everything closing at the same time, you have a lot of people going onto the streets, onto the roads at the same time. When you can stagger it, some bars closing at 2, some at 3, some at 4, you're going to have less of that intensity and it's going to be more spread out. It also gives people time to taper down. Instead of people saying, hey, it's 1 o'clock, 1:15, I better chug because closing time or last call is happening soon. People can sort of taper down if they want to stay out later to 3 or 4 o'clock.
That was always my theory. I figure if you're not sauced by 4 a.m., you're not trying. So you might as well go home. But that's probably not something that you want to say from the floor of the California Senate. Let me ask you one of the potential pitfalls of this. Let's take this region here in Southern California. Let's say Glendale decides to keep the bars open at 4 a.m. till 4 a.m., but Burbank doesn't. Is there a risk that people will, flock to Glendale from other areas to get an extra 2 hours in, and then you end up having a lot of people moving around to places?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that if that is an issue, it's an issue now, because even though the state says you can't serve alcohol past 2 a.m., there are many, many towns and cities in California that have an earlier closing time. The state doesn't say you have to go to 2 a.m. It just says you can't go past 2 a.m. So there are plenty of places that shut their bars down at 1 or midnight or even 10 or 11. And so we already have disparities where neighboring towns could be a 2 a.m. town and a midnight town. So this doesn't change that. So in terms of that dynamic, to the extent it exists, it won't change. And I don't think there's really an argument against it. That would basically say whatever in any region, whichever town that decides to have the earliest closing time gets to dictate the closing time for every other town because they don't want their residents driving to those other towns. It really doesn't make sense to me. In the end, this isn't just a random thing. Nightlife really matters. It is a key part of our culture, whether it's around music or dancing or people just having fun and being with their friends. It generates a massive amount of jobs in California, and these are working class good jobs. You don't need an advanced engineering degree to hold them. You can raise your family, and this is something that we should be encouraging.
We're talking with California State Senator Scott Wiener, who you can follow on Twitter at @Scott_Wiener. @Scott_Wiener. Who is opposed to the bill?
We've had very little opposition. We have worked closely with law enforcement, and law enforcement is generally neutral on the bill. We have a lot of support from a lot of different people and organizations who understand this is a good thing. There are some groups that are opposed to alcohol, and they don't support the bill, and they're entitled to their view. We tried prohibition in this country, and it didn't work. And frankly, even with late night past 2 a.m. Nightlife, you can try to ban it, But we know that people aren't just going to go home if they don't want to go home. And then you end up having underground nightclubs that are less safe. So let's just bring it, I don't want to say into the sunlight, but into the moonlight, and have something that's legal and safe.
Did Mothers Against Drunk Driving weigh in on this?
They have not weighed in on the bill.
Oh, that's interesting. There is.
If I could just add, we actually, I'm very sensitive to drunk driving. My aunt was killed by a drunk driver when I was a kid, so I would never author a bill that would increase drunk driving. We created actually a spreadsheet with all 50 states and what their closing time is and what their rate of drunk driving collisions is, and there's no correlation whatsoever. There's no evidence that a later closing time increases drunk driving, and that intuitively makes sense. If someone's going to leave a bar drunk, it doesn't matter if you close at midnight, 2 or 4, they're going to do it. If they're going to be responsible, it doesn't matter whether you close at midnight, 2 or 4. So there's no correlation between drunk driving and closing time.
What happens to the bill now?
So it passed out of the Senate last week with a strong two-thirds majority, bipartisan support. We had Republicans and Democrats voting for the bill. And it will now move to the Assembly and go through a couple of committee hearings in the Assembly and then on to the full Assembly. And then if we can get it through, then to the governor's desk.
Okay. Well, we're going to continue to follow the path. Is the governor given any indication of whether he'd sign this or not?
He has not. I'm a big fan of Jerry Brown. This is an issue that we'll have to see. But we'll make sure that he has all the facts about why this bill is important.
All right. I appreciate you coming on to talk to us about it.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. That's California State Senator Scott Wiener. That's only one of the many bills. We got a ton of new laws that are working their way through Sacramento, not just the extension of drinking hours. One is California is likely to recognize a third gender, male, female, and non-binary.
It's about time.
Which would allow you and your driver's license and the government documents to say that you're non-binary and therefore it's whatever you got.
I still don't get
understand. Well, whatever.
So on your driver's license to say NB?
I don't know what the designation
question
would
mark?
Be. Yeah. A question mark would be great. That would be great.
Gender?
And, of course, declaring
plumbing?
The entire state to be a sanctuary state. It pretty much is. This would just make it official. And we're also, by the way, looking at universal health care, which somebody's got to explain to me. If word gets out that by being a California resident, you have a single-payer health care system, how is that going to do anything other than bring hundreds of thousands, if not millions of more people. And by the way, this is also true regardless of your immigration status. How is this not going to be a magnet to attract more people into California by the score?
Maybe they want that.
Well, that's certainly going to be the net result.
Yeah.
And how it gets paid for is another question.
Yeah, how do we pay for that?
Massive health care overhaul that would replace insurance companies with a government-funded system for all Californians has passed the Senate, leaving the Assembly to figure out how to pay for it. This is SB 562, says redirecting existing health care spending would cover most of the universal system, but the state would need to generate as much as $100 billion in new taxes and secure approval from Washington to redirect federal health care money. We have to ask about this. What do you mean replace insurance companies? You put insurance companies out of business? There's a lot of question marks about this, so we got to get a guest on to talk to us about what it actually means. And then there's this one, because there is one that I think that a lot of us, I certainly support this, and it's a bill that would do away with daylight savings time.
Oh, we need that.
And this is Assembly Bill 807. It's a second effort in the second year in a row. It failed last time to revisit California's use of daylight savings time. The state voters first approved its use in 1949 by a ballot measure. And because of that history, the issue has to go back to the voters. So once again, this is something we'd have to undo by ballot measure. But does it make any sense? Is there any practical utility in daylight savings time in California?
It increases traffic deaths.
Oh, please, I don't buy that.
People are late for work.
In 2017?
Or early.
I just think that because the digital clocks are so hard to set in your car, that people will vote for it just to get rid of it for that reason alone.
Well, and I know you personally want this because you have about 50 cuckoo clocks you got to wind at home.
That's not true. Sundials. I got to wind my sundials.
Well, wasn't this done before for farmers for like so they had extra daylight for farming?
And that's what I was always told. But I actually heard a different history on this, that the reason they did it was for urban school districts. The cost of heating the classrooms was too high. So I don't know.
I never thought it was the farmer thing because the roosters don't know about daylight savings time. They still crow when it's sun up.
Yeah, well, the idea was to give extra daylight during the peak crop and growing season to allow people to work in the fields more. But the bottom line is we got robots doing that now, so it doesn't really matter. We spent quite a bit of time talking about this because it's fascinating. All of us were shaped by our teenage summer jobs. Why aren't American teenagers working anymore was a piece by Bloomberg at Bloomberg.com. And it's pretty interesting because the labor statistics for teens is pretty good. The national unemployment rate fell to 4.3% in May. For teenagers aged 16 to 19, it's 14.3%, which seems high. But back in 2009, it was 27%. The problem is that unemployment numbers only cover those who are actively seeking work. And increasingly so, that's not the case, that young people are not necessarily seeking summer jobs. They're seeking either the Xbox 360 partners or maybe volunteer work to pad their resume for college apps, etc. Let's talk about this with the author of the piece, personal finance reporter at Bloomberg, Ben Sieverman. Ben, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you coming on. So, you know, there are obviously cultural changes and cultural shifts. But certainly I'm of the age where getting a job was something that was, you know, you reach a certain age. For me, my first job was I was 14 when I got an official job that came with a paycheck. And it was the most exciting thing in the world, even though it paid $1.65 an hour. You worked enough hours, they put real money in your pocket.
Right, right. It used to be a rite of passage for teenagers. Almost everybody got a job. You got a job. Jobs with your friends, and that's just not the case anymore. You know, basically less than half of kids, even in July, the peak of the summer, are working or looking for work.
What are some of the phenomenon that have resulted in this change?
Well, I mean, what's happening is a lot of older workers are working. So you have a record number of people past age 65 working. And there's this economists think that maybe some of these older workers are taking jobs, say, at fast food joints or retail stores. They're taking the jobs that teenagers used to have. And maybe employers would rather employ an older worker who has a little more experience and knows how to take direction versus somebody who's never had a job before. So there's more competition for kids in the job market, but they're also busier and they're not out looking for jobs. They're doing some other things.
Well, how do they pay for stuff? I mean, is it just that mom and dad are subsidizing their layabout lifestyles?
Well, I don't know if they have layabout lifestyles, because if you look at the statistics on like school enrollment, and basically we have 40% of kids who are in school in July these days. The academic calendar has gotten longer. Kids are taking harder classes. They're taking not just summer school to make up for classes they failed, but they're also taking enrichment courses and they're going to summer camp. Now, where does the money come from? I think it does come from the parents.
We're talking with Ben Sieverman, who's the personal finance reporter at Bloomberg, and you can follow him at BSTEVERMAN on Twitter. One of the things that you talk about in this piece is the older workers who are staying in. And then this is interesting, especially for us in Southern California. We have a large undocumented population. Immigrants are competing with teens for jobs. A 2012 study found that less educated immigrants affected employment for U.S. native-born teenagers far more than for native-born adults. And I bring this up because we've had, and this is anecdotal, but I've been doing this for 20 years, and I've heard a lot of stories from employers who made a decision when they found out that there was a large block of potential employees who would work essentially for the same wages as kids, but you didn't have to replace them come August or September when the kids go back to school. And because they were supporting themselves or their families, they were less likely to call in sick because it was a good beach day. And a lot of jobs that once went to teenagers are now being occupied by people working on that first rung of the ladder of success.
Yeah, I think immigrants and older workers are the same thing. They're really potent potent competition for teens in the workplace, because teens, first of all, they have to learn how to have a boss and how to work in a workplace, and that's something that a lot of them just don't know how to do yet. But also, they don't have the kind of flexibility that other workers do. You have a lot of high school activities. You've got a lot of, the school calendar takes up a lot of their time, and so an employer just can't schedule them anytime they want. They have to really work with these kids and all the other activities they have.
We're talking with the personal finance reporter for Bloomberg, Bloomberg.com, by the way, and the piece is called Why Aren't American Teenagers Working Anymore? This phenomenon, I'll give you an example of one job in particular where teenagers have lost it. When I was a kid, delivering newspapers was a kid's job. You got a bicycle,
yep.
You had a basket or a sack that went on the front, and you rode up and down the neighborhood, and yep. You threw newspapers
into
the
driveway. You got a route. That's right.
But now it's very rare. Newspapers are delivered out of the back of Toyota or Datsun pickup trucks in the wee small hours of the morning, and they're usually contracted out by people who have a franchise to do so. That's just one of a million jobs that were once done by kids that aren't done anymore.
I think one thing going on here is that the amount of money that a kid can earn from doing these jobs, especially if they're growing up in a middle class or upper middle class home, it's really not going to make much of a difference if they're planning to go to college and they're going to spend $50,000 for a private college. $725 an hour job is just not going to make any difference to the economics of that family. Now, there's plenty of families where kids working really does make a difference, but for a lot of families are saying, hey, let's just let the kid not work and focus on getting that athletic scholarship or getting that academic scholarship that can really pay off in the long run.
Well, I can see how that happens again, and you're right that when college used to be $3,000 a year as opposed to $62,000 a year, that minimum wage summer job isn't going to really make that big of a dent.
But our parents made us get jobs just for the fact of having a job and being responsible. It wasn't so much for the money.
Well, we got a job because there was no way I was getting a dime out of my father if there wasn't some labor on the other end of it.
Exactly.
That's just the way it worked. Hey, Ben, thanks for coming on with us. Appreciate it. It's an interesting story.
You're welcome.
All right, let's go and talk DWP, which is one of the major political entities in the city of Los Angeles. A political entity? It's the Water and Power Company, yeah? It's that, and it's a whole lot more. The L.A. City Council backed a proposed legal settlement that could reduce the electric bills of DWP customers by hundreds of millions of dollars over the next 4 years. Let's talk about it with a man who knows this stuff inside and out, our old pal Jack Humphreyville. Welcome aboard. How are you?
Hello, Doug. I'm very well. Thank you very much.
Welcome aboard. Jack is the president of DWP Advocacy Committee and is the L.A. watchdog at citywatchla.com. Jack, I've been arguing for 20 years that if the DWP runs surpluses that then are used to patch over the general revenue fund budget of the city of Los Angeles, and they have literally held it as extortion. If they didn't get rate increases, they wouldn't turn the money over. That happened a few years ago, that something has gone awry here. And now it looks like the courts agree with us.
Well, you know, this recent settlement, I think it's going to be filed today, is very tough to understand. It's all a lot of legal.
That's why we called you.
But, you know, this is a deal from my perspective that's been cooked up behind closed doors. You know, it's an unlevel playing field that's, you know, slanted against the ratepayers. You know, you had the guys that filed the suit. There are three nobodies that nobody knows in town. They're represented by a bunch of, you know, ambulance chaser lawyers whose main goal is to collect, you know, $10 million in fees in this particular deal. You have an arbitrator there whose main job is to get a deal done as opposed to going to court. And if he doesn't get one done, then he's not going to be either picked by the city or by the plaintiff's lawyers for any future, you know, future business. And then you have the city, which, you know, loves our money. So you have this slanted playing field. Now, you know, a couple things here. First of all, this deal was basically structured, from my understanding, back in the fall. And if it wasn't the fall, it was early January. And it's been delayed this long because the city wanted to make sure it got the November elections out of the way, where they're picking our pockets on the Metro half-cent sales tax, homeless bonds, and then in March you had the homeless sales tax. So they wanted to put the, you know, they wanted to make sure this wasn't going to screw up the works. So you have this delay, you know, associated with the elections, and I might also say the budget. The net of it is that the plaintiffs were saying basically we want to eliminate the transfer fee, and we want the $1.8 billion that has been paid since the passage of Prop 26 in November of 2010. Now here's what we got. They're going to put a $52 million settlement in there. That's going to come from the DWP, from monies that we've already paid. Nothing from the city, and not a damn dime. So this $52 million settlement fee is then going to be reduced to, you know, $40 million, primarily because of probably $10 million in legal fees. So that's a pretty fat payday for a bunch of lawyers who are, you know, chasing ambulances, for crying out loud. The other thing that happens is that they're not going to end the transfer fee. Yes, it's going to go down to $242 million as opposed to $291, but it's still a pretty fat payday for the city. Putting this into proper perspective, of the $1.8 billion that ratepayers have paid over the last – since 2011, you know, subsequent to the passage of Prop 26, we're getting $40 million back. That's 2.2%. For the average household, that's going to be 10 bucks. And if you live in a, you know, single family house as opposed to an apartment, it's probably 20 bucks.
All right. So we got to just go take that now, buy lottery tickets and parlay this into our retirement.
Absolutely. You know, so, you know, it's a diddly, you know, diddly set settlement.
Now, have you written about this on City Watch?
In the past, I have, and I'm in the midst of, you know, this is a great call today because you made me do my thinking ahead of time.
Good.
Before I write an article today.
Well, folks, make sure you read Jack's column at the L.A. Watchdog at citywatchla.com because it is complex. And once he gets it in print, it'll be easy for you to just print it out and to go through it and see if any of this is going to actually solve the problem. Jack, thank you, sir. You're listening to Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre. Make sure you listen to McIntyre in the Morning weekdays 5 to 10 on Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.
It's the Arroyo Seco Weekend on KLOS. Nearly every hour, score two-day passes to the foodiest festival around.
With Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Weezer, Live, Alabama Shakes, Hits in the Tantrums, and more.
Win tickets this weekend on KLOS, and your name goes in the hat for a VIP ticket upgrade. With preferred parking passes.
The Arroyo Seco Weekend.
Win on the Rock of Southern California, 95.5 KLOS.
Tickets provided by Golden Voice.
Progressive presents Mind Flowness with Flow.
You find yourself lying on a beach, feeling warm sand sink between your toes. You ask a passing seagull how you achieved this bliss. Saving money, the seagull whispers, by bundling your auto and motorcycle insurance. You thank the seagull. He steals your sandwich.
Ascend to a higher plane of insurance. Bundle your policies and save with Progressive. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states.
Do you hear that racket? That is the sound of seven scientists at ExxonMobil thinking, working. Listen. They're discovering the precise combination of seven key ingredients in Synergy gasoline that helps you get better gas mileage. These science folks sure know how to party.
Shh.
Sorry. Synergy gasoline from Exxon and Mobil. Energy lives here.
Fuel economy claims are compared with gasoline meeting minimum government standards. Results will vary. Visit Exxon.com or Mobil.com for details.
Hi, this is Bo Bachman from Galpin Motors. I am proud to say that last month was the best month in Galpin's 70-year history. We also took in more trade-ins than we know what to do with. Rather than taking them to auction, we are having a huge used car sale. Right now, on every used vehicle at Galpin, you can get 0% APR financing for 60 months and make no payments for 90 days. Also, get oil and filter changes for 2 years. And Galpin's lifetime used car warranty is included with almost every used vehicle. And you choose from over 1,000 used vehicles in stock. That's at Galpin Ford, Galpin Honda, Galpin Mazda, Galpin Volkswagen, Galpin Santa Clarita, Galpin Premier, and Galpin Kia. So if you've been waiting for the right time to get a used vehicle, now is the time at Galpin's huge used car sale.
Galpin's giant used car sale going on now. Call 1-800-GO-GALPIN or visit galpin.com.
At the Home Depot, we've got more great ways to do windows than anyone. Choose from a huge selection, in-store and online. Design custom window treatments in-store or use our online tool. Even schedule an in-home appointment with a designer. With so many choices, nobody does windows like we do. Come in now for easy-to-use cordless options, like faux wood blinds starting at only $24.97. From America's number one retailer of blinds and shades, The Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Offer valid through June 30th in-store and online while supplies last.
Hey, America, want some fun?
Yes.
Want some games?
Yes.
Tonight on ABC.
You got what you asked for.
Amy Schumer and Kelly Clarkson go toe-to-toe on the premiere of Celebrity Family Feud.
One of you is headed to YouTube.
And Steve Harvey puts the fun in funding big ideas in the new Funderdome.
You seen it all?
Oh, yeah, I thought I did.
Then the return of the $100,000 pyramid.
I love this game.
It all starts tonight, 8, 7 Central, part of ABC's Summer Fun and Games.
Drains are clogged, your sink's backed up, your toilet's on the fritz. And when you need a plumber now, just simply call Ritz. We're master plumbers, we're really nice, we're big on service, not on price.
Call Ritz Plumbing at 888-757-RITZ. They're no rooter guys here, only full-service professional plumbers. You got a kitchen or bath problem? Need an earthquake valve installed? How about a tankless water heater? Well, Ritz Plumbing specializes in trenchless sewer repair, drain cleaning and maintenance, and yes, even rooter service. Plus, 12-month interest-free financing is possible. So call Ritz Plumbing, 888-757-RITZ. Ritz Plumbing, they're the real thing, only full-service professional plumbers, and here comes the clean pipe chorus. Hit it, guys.
So when you need some plumbing in California, yay, simply call Ritz. Don't flush your money.
Ritz Plumbing, 888-757-RITZ.
Progressive presents Mind Flowness with Flo.
Imagine yourself on a boat drifting on the cool, clear water. You haven't a care in the world because the boat is protected by Progressive. You are the skipper of the SS Feelgood, and you're setting sail for Happy Town, where you're the mayor. Mayor Skipper, long may he reign.
Put your mind at ease. Protect your boat with insurance from Progressive. Call 1-800-PROGRESSIVE or visit progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
If your go-to pickup line is conventional or synthetic, then CarQuest Auto Parts is for you. If your high school sweetheart was a 67 Mustang, then CarQuest is for you. CarQuest is for those who really know and care about their car. And right now, get 5 quarts of Valvoline conventional motor oil and a Purolator filter for just $23.99. CarQuest is serious auto parts.
Limited time while supplies last. Limit 5 for customers. See store or advanceautoparts.com for details.
95.5 KLOS.
Spotlight on the Community now resumes with Doug McIntyre.
As you know, Dr. Drew Pinsky, who is heard every day from noon to 3 with Mike Catherwood, has been warning about the dangers of opioid addiction for really his entire public career. And this story cannot be talked about often enough. It's a scourge. It's a pandemic. And this is an amazing story. The New York Daily News reporting, drug overdoses are the leading cause of death among people under the age of 50. Not cancer, not heart attack, not car accidents, drug overdoses. Here's Dr. Drew. Good morning, Dr. Drew. How are you?
I'm well, guys, and it's not a surprise to me at all. I, as I think back on the evolution of this epidemic, I remember saying now, when Heath Ledger died, I announced this is the lip of a tsunami. This is the wave is heading towards us and about to crash. You will not believe how profound it is, because all I was doing back then, and I mean all I was doing, was taking patient off prescription opiates. It got exhausting. And then as soon as I would get them off and get them stabilized, somebody would put them back on again. It was demoralizing. And when they added in, which was always the case, a benzodiazepine, which is what killed Chris Cornell, or what contributed to his death, which is the Valium, Clonopin, Ativan category, Ambien, When you add that into an opiate, people stop breathing. So it's the hidden epidemic now, just so you know, is what's concerning me. People aren't talking about that piece of this. They're finally getting the message about the opiates. The fentanyl has everyone's attention, like, oh, my God, they're giving fentanyl instead of heroin. Drug addicts will use whatever the best product is. Fentanyl is what's available. It's better than heroin. They're going to use fentanyl. It's just a little more dangerous. But still, the really serious problem that is killing otherwise healthy people is the opiate-benzodiazepine combination.
62,000 people died from overdoses in 2016, a 19% increase from 2015. And it's the worst in Ohio, which is might seem, well, why Ohio? Well, if you read Hillbilly Elegy, you might understand why it's so bad in Ohio. That's a book, J.D. Vance's book. It's I'm about halfway through it now. It's an eye-opener, to say the least. Deaths from overdoses rose 25% last year. It is the only aspect of American health that's getting worse, as Dr. Tom Frieden, former director of the CDC, told the New York Times. And fentanyl, a narcotic that used to treat extreme pain, has been linked to more than double the amount of drug-induced seizures over the past year as well. There you go, Dr. Drew.
Yeah, but the fentanyl is for whatever reason, people are clinging to that story. That is a corollary. That's a piece of the story. The story is what my peers have perpetrated. We have perpetrated a catastrophe. And every time there's been an opiate epidemic in this country, it has been at the hands of physicians. The one that followed the Civil War, physicians again.
Yep.
And at that time, once they got control over it, which we're finally doing now, although the benzodiazepines weren't available then, and that piece has not yet been told, they're not being received by the public yet, and not by my peers, really. Again, witness Chris Cornell. But back then, they got control over the prescribing, and then they looked around and said, well, what are we going to do with all of these addicts that we've created? And they kind of went, well, wink, wink, they'll go away. And that, to me, is just reprehensible. We need to really focus now on what we do with all these. There are tens of millions of people that, because we decided the pain was the fifth vital sign, and by the way, that was perpetrated by attorneys and patient advocacy groups, foisted on us by government agencies. That's where the rubber hit the road. If you remember in the 90s in California, Florida, doctors were accused of patient abuse and fined and put in prison if they didn't, quote, adequately treat pain. That's where this epidemic got rocket fuel.
And then you have this story today that I'm reading in New York about the doctor. He's 81, arrested for illegally prescribing millions of oxycodone pills over the last, like, 5 years that were worth more than $20 million. You have somebody like him just passing them out to people, just paying them for a prescription.
But what's scary is there's a discipline in medicine that would still defend that behavior. The discipline holds that pain is what the patient says it is. Who are we to say when they have pain control? Pain control is achieved when the patient says it's achieved. And that group will only admit to the fact that perhaps 30% of patients get a little bit of a problem. They are afraid of the term addiction. They feel as though diagnosing somebody with addiction is somehow judging them or somehow casting aspersion on the patient, as opposed to just calling out a brain disease. And I will tell you, it's not 30%. It's more like 70 or 80% of people develop disabling consequences from their relationship with opiates.
Let's go back to the headline, Dr. Drew. This is now the leading cause of death among people under 50. Now,
yep.
Under 50, you would think that it's rare for heart attacks and even cancer to take people out. But we used to have car accidents, and believe it or not, gun violence, homicide was a factor, certainly among younger people. But now it's just simply people offing themselves with bad combinations of drugs.
And remember, you're forgetting the fact that I believe it was about 18, 24 months ago, drug overdoses overtook everything in young adults. It's just the only new information in this headline is it is now expanded all the way to the age of 50. Which you got to remember that, you know, people didn't live past 40 very often at the turn of the century. There's many infectious diseases and vascular diseases and various cancers and whatnot that people can get, and we can still get those things. Those have been left in the dust because of this thing we've all created.
Dr. Drew, by the way, can be followed on Twitter at Dr. Drew, and of course heard every day here, midday live from noon to three with Mike Catherwood. And this has been a raison d'etre for Dr. Drew for many years to talk about this. And Doug Ducey, who is the Arizona governor, he declared a state of emergency because of the spike in prescription pain pill and heroin overdoses in his state. We know that the governor of Vermont a couple of years ago did the State of the State address and spent the entire speech just talking about heroin addiction in Vermont. And people saying, what in the world is that about? Well, what it was about was the tip of the spear. He was the first one that I remember, first elected official, who called attention to what was obviously an explosive problem.
But remember, the reason we have all these heroin addicts is because physicians overprescribed opiates and then cut these patients off as opposed to getting them treatment. And when you cut an opiate addict off, the state they're in requires that they find an alternative source of opiates. The cheapest, best route right now, fentanyl. So that's where they're going, period, end. Unless you intervene, unless you do something aggressively in terms of treatment for these people, their life is in danger. And it's not their fault. We've rendered them this way. And it's so concerning. And I will again repeat, we're still not telling the whole story. And Chris Cornell is another lip of a tsunami. There is a hazard risk to being on a benzodiazepine routinely. If you're on it with an opiate, it's life-threatening combination and needs to be managed extremely carefully. And that story has yet to be told.
Hey, Drew, I want to pull a pop quiz on you if I could. So feel free to.
I'm very good at these things. Leanne, help me out. Go ahead.
Well, feel free to walk away from this question if you want to. But, you know, we're sitting here with a guy in Paris now shot who decided to take a hammer and attack a cop at Notre Dame Cathedral. And this comes in the aftermath of what went on in London when three guys decided this is the day we'll die and we'll just get in the car and we'll run over as many people as possible. And then when we can't run over anybody else, we'll hop out with knives and just stab them until we're shot to death. And I'm wondering, in your practice, have you ever encountered a person whose malleability would frighten you to the point where they could be weaponized as a human being?
There's two things. I sort of would put that more in the cult category, with people that are sort of, we used to call it brainwashing. I mean,
right.
The people that are brought into a way of looking at the world and a way of thinking and a little so-called family that they can't let down. I've seen people engage in really disturbing behaviors because they are sort of brought into that environment. And make no mistake, these organizations use the precise same techniques. It's nothing different at all, although I've never seen this explicitly. What I wonder is if there's any crossover with criminality, which is something that I don't deal with very well, because criminals sort of – if, you know, there's really a criminal mindset, which is everything is sort of nonsense and BS, and I don't trust anything no matter what. Even when you sort of get them engaged, they'll go so far and then they'll just pull out. And I just don't find that very fruitful, so I haven't spent a lot of time with those kinds of people.
Yeah, just curious, because it's utterly fascinating to me, this concept. It's like the brains of these people who are behaving this way are wired so different from from normal
rational
human
people.
Beings, like that they literally can just act on a capricious whim that today's just a good day to just go and hit
meet
a cop with a hammer.
And
we were talking with Tim Clemente, a former CIA profiler, a special ops guy, and he was telling us that in one case they had one guy who was promised cinnamon rolls in the afterlife.
And
cinnamon
that did
rolls.
It. Yeah.
And that was enough for him to go and throw his life away and try to take others with him.
Yeah, it's clearly a different state of probably biology than probably some predisposing biology to this, but certainly predisposing experiences, trauma, that sort of thing, and then the cultivation process that makes it so far from the average human social context that we can't get our head around it. And I'm one of those people. I can't. Maybe I don't want to. There certainly a piece of that too. I don't want to know what's going on in that brain.
Yeah, inside of that head is a bad part of town.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, Drew, thanks so much as always. Enjoy New York.
You got it. Thank you, guys.
Okay. Dr. Drew, midday live from noon to three at Dr. Drew. President Trump made an announcement for a separate air traffic control to separate the air traffic control system from the federal government. In other words, to spin that off, privatize the air traffic control system would still be supervised by the FAA. If you remember, of course, back one of the major moments of the Reagan administration was the PATCO strike, the union that represented the air traffic controllers. And Ronald Reagan fired them all and replaced them. And it was, of course, prophecy that this would lead to mid-air collisions and a catastrophe. It did not. But to find out what this is all about, we turn to one of the experts, CNN's aviation analyst and a former Department of Transportation Inspector General, Mary Schiavo. Good morning, Ms. Schiavo. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning. It's good to be with you. Thank you.
We appreciate having you. So what about this? The president was saying that this is a much-needed reform, that the air traffic control system is antiquated. It was set up for when there were X amount of thousands of flights, and now we have many, many more than that. Right. So what do you make of what you've heard thus far?
Well, you know, the president's actually correct on what he said yesterday, and this has been something, privatizing air traffic control, and it's not technically privatizing. It's a quasi-government corporation. It would be a not-for-profit corporation that the government would still have some hand in, but it was actually President Clinton that tried to do that in the 90s because of the same problem. The same problem that President Trump is trying to address has been going on literally since the late 80s, early 90s, and that is that the Federal Aviation Administration cannot deliver the largest computerization contract literally in the history of the world, which is the new air traffic control system. They haven't been able to get it done. The wasted money of President Trump yesterday said $7 billion. It's probably more like $20 billion if you add in all the years of waste. So it's kind of a Hail Mary pass here. We have to have the new system, and the FAA hasn't delivered it, and time's running out.
Well, this is a question that's probably above your pay grade, but it's almost an existential question. Well, I don't know what it is about government computer system rollouts, whether it was the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. The LAUSD, the Los Angeles Unified School District, had a computer payroll system that was so screwed up. It was a $95 million system. It cost $295 million to fix it. The Department of Water and Power here in L.A., their billing computers are still screwed up. I don't know why it is that, man, they have trouble rolling out new computer systems.
Well, because the government personnel, and I guess somewhat of an apologist here, but the government personnel are not, you know, are not trained in the computer processes. They're not IT and computer personnel. For example, at the FAA, they hire from within, they promote from within. The people at the top of the FAA, you know, one of them started in HR, and that's the way they promote and hire in the government, and that's the way the government system's set up. Now, we know how you have to handle computer. I mean, if you go to sleep overnight, something has changed in the computer science IT world. They're just not set up to deal with it, and that's why contracting out for these huge computer programs makes sense.
Yeah, it certainly does. We're talking about Mary Schiavo. Now, what is the weakness of the current system? What is it that we need this computer system to do?
Well, we've now reached the point in air traffic and air transportation where literally the human being is not going to be able to do it. The whole idea of the next-gen air traffic control system is that there would be basically three different systems, one running all the time, one for maintenance, and one for backup, because there's so much traffic that a human being has difficulty keeping track of it. And now, remember, we're putting into the system drones, pilotless aircraft and other aircraft, and we've already reached the turning point. There are now more drones than there are piloted aircraft, and it's very difficult to integrate all this traffic. And so what we're doing with the new system is we're getting air traffic off the highways in the sky. It's you know, the old system is like thinking of the 405 and the 10 and the 110 all coming together, and all the aircraft are lined up on the entrance ramps. Well, with the new system, there's no such thing. You go from point to point, and it's estimated that it'll reduce delays by at least 35%, which is a huge cost savings, but it also opens up more of the skies. We don't have everybody waiting to be on the same highway. We can send them point to point, and it reduces delays and reduces the chance of mid-air collisions, which the new system is supposed to virtually eliminate.
Now, Mary, I don't know if this is true or not, but I remember hearing over the years that I thought that there was always there was always a need for air traffic controllers. Like, they were overworked, they were understaffed. Could this help in that department as well?
Well, it can help, but it won't be an unmanned system. We will always have air traffic controllers to oversee the system. But the theory is, as computerized planes and mechanization in the cockpit has helped dramatically reduce air crashes, the thought is that the computer itself will perhaps have a lower error rate, hopefully, than the human. So we will still have these 14,000 air traffic controllers would literally be switched over to the payroll of this not-for-profit quasi-governmental corporation that will run air traffic control. But ideally, yes, they will be the backup in the system.
We're talking with Mary Schiavo, CNN's aviation analyst and the former Department of Transportation Inspector General. The crowded skies, whenever I fly, I mean, I'm not one of those people that flies twice a week, but I fly, 10, 12, sometimes more than that a year. And every time you lift off and you get away from an airport, it's amazing. It's rare that you ever see another aircraft out the window, the spacing between planes. So when we talk about the crowding of the skies, is most of the congestion around the airports themselves for takeoffs and landings getting into the pattern?
Absolutely, and not even around airports themselves. If you include private airports, for example, we have 16,000 airports in the United States of America. Most of the crowding occurs around the top 20 airports. 20 airports is where the crowding and the risk and the delays occur. And the idea here also is that for those airports where there's a tremendous crowding and backlog, the new system would be able to reduce the separation. Now, I'm not in favor of that. I think the separation is important for many reasons. But it will also be able to have so many other paths and routings and perhaps make more useful the rest of the airports in the country as well. But you're absolutely right. Most of the crowding happens at 20 airports.
And we have very crowded skies here in Southern California. When I first moved here, I was flirting with the idea of getting a pilot's license. So I took lessons out of Whiteman Air Park, which is an uncontrolled field. Mm-hmm. And Whiteman Air Park, the southern tip of the uncontrolled airport out in Pacoima, is, I think, only 2.5 miles from the northern tip of the main runway at Burbank Airport. And, in fact, right, a 737 years ago tried to come down and almost landed at Whiteman Air Park before it finally got called off. It went off the radar screen at Burbank, and they finally got the pilot and said, no, you're going to the wrong field. But, I mean, it's really crowded between Long Beach and John Wayne, Ontario, Burbank, Van Nuys, Santa Monica, obviously LAX. There's planes going up in Lancaster, Palmdale. There's airports all over the place.
Right. But now you brought up sort of tangentially the issue here. So now there's lots of aviation out there that isn't, big. Not the scheduled service, not military, not people that have all this equipment. So to be able to fly in the next generation air traffic control system, you have to have the onboard computer equipment that allows you to be seen by the computers. And the people who are resisting this are persons, a lot of them, not all of them, some of these are all for it, but people in general aviation whose planes are not equipped to do this. And they say, well, this is very expensive for us to fly in the system. So we have, if you're going to fly like Wilbur and Orville, you're going to have a hard time flying in next gen.
Yeah, well, that is a real problem. If you've owned a Cessna 150 or 152 or a Piper Cub, these are sort of the entry level airplanes that that civilian aviation depends on. And now all of a sudden, I mean, there was a time when you could buy a Cessna 150 for $12,000. Mm-hmm. But if
that's
you
right.
have to have a navigation system that can cost $200,000.
Yes, that's right. And remember, you can get, unpiloted, pilotless aircraft with more computerization on board than some of these old planes. And so what's going to happen is as we transition into this new system, obviously there will be certain levels of airspace that will be still flown by see and avoid rules. In other words, general aviation, you can still fly by looking out your window and avoiding the aircraft, but you won't be able to go into these airports that are controlled with these direct approach next gen approaches, because the computer has to see everything in the air to keep this traffic going in this precision safely and efficiently.
Well, you know, this sounds like the aviation equivalent of driverless cars commingling.
Yes.
With people's classic cars. You know, it's one thing to have a smart car, but somebody else is driving, you know, a 1968 a Porsche Boxster or whatever they made in 1968. And that's their, you know, their baby. They still want to drive that car. It's going to be on the road with cars with electric eyes and all kinds of collision avoidance, but they don't have it.
That's right, and it's going to be a problem for the FAA. However, it's going to be tougher for the road the driverless cars than the FAA, because contrary to what people say, and you've heard some of the old timers say, "Oh, it's my God-given right to fly." Well, actually, it's not, because the airspace and the system of the United States of America and all countries is a very important public asset, and you're not allowed to be in it by federal law unless you comply with the law. So there will be flight levels set out for see and avoid flight, for visual flight rules, but to keep everyone safe in this very complicated system with 1 billion passengers a year, they're going to have to comply with the computerization system.
Well, you know, when Lindbergh flew to Paris, he flew with no window, a gas tank over the windshield, and no lights on the plane. And, of course, he didn't have to worry about hitting anybody because there wasn't anybody. So,
but then don't forget he got lost. He had to fly low over Ireland and say, "Hey, where am I?"
Right. He asked a fishing boat where he was.
Air traffic control.
Yes, a primitive form of it. Hey, listen, Mary, thanks so much for coming on and talking with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Okay. Mary Schiavo from formerly of the FAA. This has been Spotlight on the Community, 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre, Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.